Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with questions arising after the recent rash of mass shootings about the loopholes and gaps in the national instant criminal background check system that allowed a mentally ill, Hitler-loving, anti-abortion zealot to buy a gun at a pawn shop used in the cinema massacre in Lafayette, enabled a young racist with outstanding criminal charges to buy the automatic used to gun down worshippers at the AME Church in Charleston, and made it easy for the shooter in Chattanooga to purchase assault rifles over the internet used to kill American servicemen. A former special agent with the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco and Firearms, Dr. William Vizard, Professor Emeritus and Chair of the Division of Criminal Justice at California State University, Sacramento, joins us to discuss what can be done to shore up a broken system that is supposed to prevent felons and the mentally ill from getting hold of lethal firepower. Then we'll look into a leaked test report from a series of dogfight tests between the brand new F-35 Joint Strike Fighter and a 30-year-old F-16 trainer at Edwards Flight Test Center that demonstrated that the performance of the F-35 is inferior to the current fighters it is designed to replace. Mandy Smithberger, director of the Strauss Military Reform Project at the Project on Government Oversight, joins us to discuss Lockheed's $1.4 trillion gold-plated turkey that is the world's most expensive weapon system, and her article at the Center for Defense Information and POGA.org, leaked F-35 report confirms serious air combat deficiencies. Then finally, we will speak with Francis Nujubi Nesbitt, a professor of Africana Studies at San Diego State University, who previously worked as a reporter and sub-editor for The Daily Nation in Nairobi, Kenya. He joins us to discuss his article at Foreign Policy in Focus, Obama's Last Chance in Africa, and President Obama's address to the African Union in Ethiopia, where he criticized kleptocratic African strongmen who cling to power indefinitely. And joining us now is Dr. William Vizard, who is a professor emeritus and chair of the Division of Criminal Justice at California State University, Sacramento. He's the author of Shots in the Dark, Policy, Politics, and Symbolism of Gun Control, and Shots in the Dark, A Political History of the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, as well as numerous articles on gun control, justice, policy, policing, and investigation. Dr. Vizard served 30 years in law enforcement with the Fresno County Sheriff's Department and as a special agent with the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dr. William Vizard.
Thank you.
And in terms of the questions now being raised, there's a front-page story in today's New York Times about deficiencies in the national instant criminal background check system. Since it's administered, I believe, by the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, what are the deficiencies, and who's responsible for them?
Well, let me correct one thing. It's not administered by the ATF. It's administered actually by the FBI. They run the records checks. That was Congress's decision. The deficiencies are deficiencies in law and also in process. I mean, the instance in Louisiana. You have an individual who is apparently committed for observation. Commitment for observation does not subject one to being a prohibited purchaser or possessor of a firearm. Only if you are involuntarily committed by a court or adjudicated mentally incompetent by a court are you going to be prohibited under the law from possessing a firearm. So the individual wasn't, you know, he bought it legally because he wasn't prohibited. In the case of the South Carolina shooting, much has been made by the fact that about the fact that this individual had a previous drug arrest and said he used drugs. Well, persons currently addicted to unlawful drugs are prohibited. The problem there is, even though they missed the arrest, people have implied that somehow it would have been blocked. That's really questionable because you've got to prove that the person is currently addicted to a drug. So the fact that somebody used a drug a year ago or 2 years ago or 4 years ago That section on addicted individuals is pretty much dysfunctional, because it's very, very difficult to demonstrate that a person's currently addicted. And even if you do, frankly, you may block a sale, but the United States attorneys aren't going to prosecute those. They will prosecute felons in possession of firearms in most jurisdictions, but persons addicted, they're very weak on prosecuting. So that was something thrown in. That was a prohibition thrown in by Congress when they passed the law in 68, but it's very difficult to practically apply it. If you really want to control, and then you have another whole problem, and that's that the secondary market in firearms, gun shows and private individual sales, don't go through any check at all. So even though these sales went through a check, and the easiest way to get a gun is to go down and buy it at a gun store, secondary checks, and this is not true in California, secondary checks are sales are mandated to be run through a criminal records check. But in most states, they're not. There's no waiting period in most states. And so you can simply buy a gun from another individual or at a gun show. People can advertise guns on the Internet. They can advertise them in a newspaper. They have to sell them to a resident of their own state. But there's no, virtually no controls over those.
And they result in or are responsible for 40% of all gun sales, right? Private sales.
Yeah, a large number of gun sales are secondary sales, private sales. And the only way, I mean, there's no surefire way of preventing a category of people from obtaining guns. They're just any more than there's a way of preventing people from obtaining other prohibited items. You can make it more difficult. You can make it more effective. You can't make it foolproof. If we were really concerned with what, you know, leaving aside prohibition, which is clearly, now that the Supreme Court has decided the Second Amendment's an individual right, prohibition is completely off the table, and it was politically off the table anyway. There was no way it was going to happen in the United States. But assuming we're going to put aside the British approach, which is basically, you know, there are whole categories of firearms like handguns that just won't be in circulation. Assuming you're putting that aside and you want to try to regulate who can acquire firearms without pre-clearing people and going to some kind of a permissive licensing system. In other words, you know, you want to possess firearms, you go in, you get a pre-clearance. There's time to do a more of a background check rather than just a criminal records check, and follow things up and not, you know, be mandated by a few days that you have to make a delivery, along with a registration system that tracks, you know, whether firearms have been lawfully transferred from one individual to another and makes unregistered firearms contraband. If you're not willing to do that, and there's not a shred of indication that the United States is willing to do that, and certainly this Congress would never even, they wouldn't even debate it, let alone do it, then it's very difficult to say we're going to prevent an individual from acquiring a firearm. You can increase the risk for people doing it, you know, if they bypass the law. You can make it, you know, we prevent most felons now from buying from licensed dealers, but it's almost impossible to just stop it. There's just too many. We got 300 million plus guns, we think, in the United States. Nobody has an exact count, but my estimate is over 300 million. And with 300 million guns floating around, it's very, very difficult to keep a person from acquiring one, particularly in states that have no control over secondary transfers.
And again, I'm speaking with Dr. William Bazard. He's a professor emeritus and chair of the Division of Criminal Justice at California State University, Sacramento. He's the author of Shots in the Dark, Policy, Politics, and Symbolism of Gun Control, and Shots in the Dark, A Political History of the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms. Dr. Bazard served 30 years.
Actually, the second book is In the Crossfire, not both called Shots in the Dark.
Oh, it's In the Crossfire. I'm sorry.
And I'm former chair. I'm now retired. So.
Yes. In the Crossfire. Okay, sorry. You served 30 years in law enforcement with the Fresno County Sheriff's Department and as a special agent with the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms. I knew that the FBI did conduct these background checks through the National Instant Criminal Background Check system. But I was watching CNN this morning where they did a piece with a CNN reporter down in Atlanta who just went into a gun store and they showed the whole process where he got to fire the guns and then he literally walked out with them because different states are more permissive in terms of guns. The thing that I don't understand, and I understand that the NRA has been largely responsible for this not being the case. If, in, for example, with automobiles, the FBI used to chase stolen cars in great numbers, and they have these VIN numbers. Each car is identified.
Right.
I don't understand why guns aren't. There isn't a national registry of guns because. You're always picking up guns at crime scenes, and we've seen all these TV shows where the gun at the crime scene leads to the felon.
Well, and it often does. And California, although it doesn't have strictly a registration system, it does record all lawful transactions, and as a result, although it's not quite a registration system, if you pick up a gun in California, you can. Go to a criminal computer or law enforcement computer in the state of California in the CLET system, and within a minute, you can determine who the last retail purchaser of that firearm was, whether it's been pawned, whether it's been sold secondhand, et cetera. But California is the only state that has that quality of records. The reason we don't have it nationally is because Congress has very specifically not only has not passed a statute to allow it, they passed specific statutes to prevent even recording the information we have. For instance, we could record the information from the instant checks, and you could trace guns more readily that way. But Congress has specifically prohibited the retention of that information. So the answer is we don't have it because the representatives of the American people have decided they don't want it. Now, that may not reflect the majority opinion of most Americans or the majority of Americans, but it represents far and away the majority opinion of those people who care enough to pay attention to this issue, to pressure their representatives, to write letters to their representatives, to contribute money to organizations, and so on. So Congress has responded to the political pressure, and the political pressure says, we don't want it. And even though large numbers of people may in surveys say, oh, yeah, I'd like to have it, they're not going to write their congressman. They're not going to contribute money to candidates. They're not going to go out and ring doorbells and do the things that would be necessary because they're not really that concerned with it. So as a result, the people who care are the ones who win the argument.
Well, it does seem to ebb and flow in that regard because I think after the Sandy Hook massacre of the schoolchildren, Obama, and against the advice of the Democrats, who said, let's not bring up gun control; it's a losing proposition. He stuck his neck out, and he was within four votes, I think, of getting some legislation passed. But I guess what the point you're making, vis-a-vis the power of the NRA and the influence over Congress, is essentially that the race goes to the swiftest; that the people who support so-called gun rights are more politically active than those people in this country who support what used to be called gun control and is now called gun safety.
Right, absolutely. I mean, there's absolutely no question about it. And in fact, public opinion I've been following this issue since the late 60s, and public opinion has actually shifted more in opposition to gun regulation than it used to be. If you go back to the 70s and the 80s. So, and even then, we really haven't passed any significant legislation regulating firearms to speak of since 1968. I mean, we passed an so-called assault weapons bill that had a 10-year sunset provision that's run out, and we passed the instant check, the Brady Bill, which is, I guess you would say, reasonably significant. But that's been it since 1968, and so it's the track record of success with gun legislation is not very good. Now, some states have taken action, and there's a real difference if you look at states like New York and California versus, Mississippi, Alabama, Texas, whatever, Utah, Colorado. Colorado's an exception. Wyoming, they run from virtually no controls whatsoever. I mean, over half the states in the United States have no laws controlling machine guns. So, there's a big disparity in points of view, and in the rural states and in the southern states, gun control is very, very unpopular.
Well, in spite of all of this, though, at least the system that we're talking about here—that's obviously has flaws and gaps in it. Apparently, it's prevented more than 2.4 million sales to either felons or the mentally ill. So,
yes. I mean, there have been a lot of sales stopped. Now, of course, we don't know how many of those people went out to the secondary market and got a gun.
Sure.
But we do know, at least, that they didn't go down and get a gun in the primary market. In California, we stopped a lot of illegal sales, and California's been doing it forever. Mm-hmm. My entire lifetime, California's been running record checks on handgun purchasers and on long gun purchasers for decades. So, there are states that are doing this, and nationally we are stopping sales to prohibited persons. But it's a lot easier dealing with felons than it is with the other categories. Felony convictions, because we've had a system of criminal records check, criminal records in the United States for, not quite a century, but for 75, 80 years, We have a fairly highly developed system of recording arrests and subsequent convictions and courts reporting disposition. Now, they don't always do it. There are cases where the courts fail to report disposition and where arrests don't get recorded. But in the vast majority of cases, felony arrests are recorded, and they're backed up by fingerprints. Virginia Tech shooting, states were very sloppy about mental commitments. Now, it's gotten better.
Mm-hmm.
There's just a lot of people with mental health issues. And start with, most of the people with mental health issues are not dangerous. But even among those who are, most have not been involuntarily committed.
Well, Dr. Williams, I'm sorry to tell you we've run out of time, but I'm very grateful for your information, and I thank you for joining us.
You're most welcome.
And again, I've been speaking with Dr. William Bizard, who's a professor emeritus and the former chair in the Division of Criminal Justice at California State University, Sacramento. He's the author of Shots in the Dark, Policy, Politics, and Symbolism of Gun Control, and In the Line of Fire, A Political History of the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms. Dr. Bizard served 30 years in law enforcement with the Fresno County Sheriff's Department and as a special agent with the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into the leaked test reports on Lockheed's $1.4 trillion gold-plated Turkey, the F-35 Joint Strike Fighter.
I know my destiny. It's like the sun. You see the best of me when I have got my gun.
And joining us now is Mandy Smithberger, who's the director of the Strauss Military Reform Project at the Project on Government Oversight. She has an article at the Center for Defense Information and at pogo.org, Leaked F-35 Report Confirms Serious Air Combat Deficiencies. Welcome to Background Briefing, Mandy Smithberger.
Thank you so much for having me.
And the F-35 is the most expensive weapon system in the history of man, and it is about $1.4 trillion?
Correct, $1.4 trillion over the lifetime of the program.
And this leak of the tests that were taken, these dogfighting tests between an F-35A test pilot with extensive dogfighting experience in F-16s and F-15s, who wrote the report. And it was up against an aging, a 30-year-old F-16, right? And it was continually outmatched in 17 dogfights. Is that the finding?
That is correct. And really, the F-16 was supposed to be the underdog in this fight. You know, it was heavier, it was older, it was not the hot shot, but the hot shot lost.
And so they rigged the test by using an old F-16 that was the training one that has had a bigger bubble canopy with more drag, plus fuel tanks, which dragged it up against an F-35 that had clean wings, right?
Correct.
So they, even in trying to rig the tests, they got creamed by the aging, the 30-year-old F-16.
Absolutely.
So what's going on here? Does it matter anymore? That here the taxpayer gets hosed for trillions of dollars to build a whole new generation of aircraft when there's nobody out there to fight against, at least nobody on the horizon, and the existing aircraft are better than what you're producing. Does it really matter anymore whether the weapons we build work? Have we become so corrupt that it's no longer an issue?
We think it still does matter. I think what is become or what was difficult was that everyone was hoping that the F-35 program was going to deliver all of the capabilities that have been promised. And for a long time, the program office could insist that the program was too immature and that it was too soon to tell whether the problems that they were finding in development were actually, you know, serious and should make us reconsider the program. What we're starting to see as the Pentagon is trying to retire these legacy platforms, and as the F-35 does become a more mature system, that not only are these problems not going away, they're getting worse, and now you really have the information you need to reevaluate whether we should continue with the program, and in particular, if it's wise to continue with the program at the current rate.
Well, my understanding is that the main problem here is that somehow or other, the Defense Department and the military-industrial complex sold the Defense Department on stealth technology as the big game changer. And all of these platforms, like this F-35 and the F-22 Raptor, that have stealth, by nature, they're not aerodynamic because they have a different function to avoid radar. So there's two problems, as far as I can see. One is that the Russians and the Chinese have the radar to detect stealth. So the advantage of stealth doesn't overcome the disadvantages of stealth in terms of aerodynamics that make these stealth planes flying turkeys.
That's correct. And the other thing to keep in mind as well is that stealth is very difficult to maintain. So it also means that these planes are less reliable and less available for us in combat.
So stealth is a hoax then. It's an idea that's past its shelf life, and yet it's crippling these new generations of airplanes that aren't competitive with cheaper models that the Russians and the Chinese are making, and the French. Is that right?
Right, though in some cases, at least some of these other countries are kind of falling for stealth and wasting some money in those circumstances. But you're starting to even see dissent within the ranks of the military-industrial complex, where you're starting to see the Navy make comments about, you know, maybe stealth isn't as valuable of a capability as we think it's going to be. Now, you know, that's not enough to really change the course of these programs and the very expensive mistakes that we've already made. But you are starting to see a little bit of an evolution in thinking on this issue.
Well, stealth can be detected by long wavelength radar, which means that the radar used by the British, the first radar actually ever deployed, used by the British in the Battle of Britain in 1940, would detect a stealth aircraft, right?
Right.
So we've come a long way.
All the way around again.
So stealth can be detected, we know now, by Russian radar. And we've gone for the short wavelength because it's more compact. But there's also other ways to detect planes now with infrared, which will pick up stealth as well, or pick up the engine. and the F-35 happens to have a very hot engine. It just has one power plant. So walk us through that as well. We know that it lost 17 out of 17 dogfights with a 30-year-old trainer version of the F-16, which has a lot more drag because it has a double canopy, and it had wing tanks on, which also slow it down. But nevertheless, it outmaneuvered the F-35A in 17 out of 17. And then we also know that the Russians and the Chinese have the radar to detect it. But they also, don't they have infrared that can also detect it?
Right. So the Russian and the Chinese fighters have infrared search and track detectors that can detect engine heat up to 70 miles away. And in the case of the F-35, there is a particularly hot invisible exhaust plume that, you know, makes the F-35 light up on their sensors.
And this plane, of course, not only is it crippled by stealth technology that makes it unaerodynamic, it also was designed to be a be-all and end-all for all the services, for landing on a carrier, naval carriers, for taking off vertically for the Marines, and for being a frontline dogfighter for the Air Force. So that's also proven to be a huge deficiency, hasn't it, that it's a one-size-fits-all project?
Yes, that has become a significant drawback, and in particular, modifications that were made for the Marine Corps variant and required a larger fuselage to be able to support that engine, which then limits the ability of the pilot to see around the plane and to also be able to be aware of rear view threats. And to compensate for that, the F-35 program has created this expensive, about $600,000 helmet to try and be able to see everything, but the problem is that the helmet crashes and that we're on our third redesign. And even with that helmet, most pilots prefer being able to see things with their own eyes and not having to work through that interface.
And if it crashes, right, they're just a sitting duck.
Correct. They are a sitting duck. Their weapons don't work. And if it's broken, you can't just put the pilot into a new plane with a new helmet. Each helmet is custom to each pilot.
And they cost $600,000 each?
They do.
And so far they're not working?
So far they're not reliable, no.
Mm. So is there anything good we can say about this plane? I mean, for $1.4 trillion, is there anything that we're getting?
I mean, there are certain capabilities that we will be getting, but it's not clear at all that this is going to be a plane that's going to be better than what we, significantly better than what we already have in our inventory. I guess some would argue that this has been a successful jobs program, but we don't really see that as the purpose of the Department of Defense.
Well, one of the things that in terms of air combat is normally the attacker comes in from behind. Because if you come in from the front, you're both moving so fast, you know, you blink of an eye, you're past each other. And from World War II, they had to quickly get to the bubble canopies on the so-called P-51 Mustang because the pilots demanded it because they were, you know, they're getting shot down from behind because they had no rear vision. And the same was true in the Korean War. And this plane, the F-35, there's no, absolutely zero rear vision, right?
Any rear vision is coming through the helmet.
So is that a problem? I mean, if history's anything to judge by, it would be, wouldn't it?
Yeah, we believe that's a significant combat risk. And in particular, since we're talking about, you know, using a very different mechanism for trying to anticipate that risk, the fact that this plane is so unreliable that pilots aren't able to get the number of training hours that they really need to be as effective as they should be in combat is concerning as well, because we certainly don't want our pilots to have to learn those lessons on the battlefield.
So is this a case then of just that the contractor, Lockheed, which in 2014 had profits of $5.5 billion, has just made this gold-plated turkey and it doesn't matter, they just keep throwing money at it, and all of the criticisms that you and the test pilot and Aviation Week and everybody that's looked into it is heaping on this plane, it just means more money for them because they'll keep modifying it. But problem, the way I see it is that this thing is never going to work because it's flawed from the get-go in very fundamental ways.
I think that's right, that it is flawed from the get-go. In addition to, you know, blaming the contractors, though, I think it's important to also hold the military services accountable, who did very little to try and, you know, restrain the requirements, think through whether having this kind of commonality was really realistic and what the ultimate cost would have to be in a system where program managers for the government shift every couple of years, so no one's ever really responsible for problems that occur along the way.
Well, I saw the 60 Minutes piece that they did on the F-35, and it was very industry-friendly and very friendly to the services, and they had an Air Force general in charge, and he was a no-nonsense straight shooter, and he was going to clean up Dodge and get this plane delivered on time. And it's just nonsense. I mean, it's not happening. I have no idea why 60 Minutes drank the Pentagon's Kool-Aid, but they certainly did in the light of what we know now.
Especially when we know what we've seen in programs like the F-22. Yeah, I'm not sure why there wasn't more scrutiny.
Well, tell us about the F-22, which is the predecessor, the Raptor. What's its record? Because for a while there, it was killing its pilots or asphyxiating them because they were recycling engine fumes into oxygen.
Right. There were issues with the oxygen system, which the F-35 program has actually experienced similar problems. And actually, right now, taxpayers are paying approximately $11.3 billion to make modifications and fixes to the F-22 planes that we've already purchased. But just due to how unaffordable that program was, we ended up buying significantly fewer planes than we had hoped to own. And similarly, because it's so expensive to maintain and difficult, we haven't used them much at all in any of our current conflicts.
So, but what about maintenance? I understand not only do they not fly very often and that they couldn't build as many as they wanted because they're so expensive, and that for a while they were asphyxiating the pilots. But the fact that one of the things I understand is that, you know, their maintenance costs are so high that they're all hangar queens.
No, I think the last statistic I saw was that the readiness rate for the fleet is something like 65%. So a little more than half of the time is an F-22 plane ready.
So wouldn't you have thought that the experience of the F-22, which preceded the F-35, would have been a learning experience, and somebody would have been alerted to the fact that there's something wrong with stealth technology and this whole new generation of aircraft, which, again, the F-35 is the most expensive weapon system in human history.
Right. You would think that there would be some kind of lesson learned. I think part of it is that because the F-22 has been used so little in combat, we haven't been able to really see just how ineffective that stealth technology actually is. We just know that this is a plane that, as you say, is a hangar queen.
Well, even the radar that, which, you know, we've made some advances in the radar. My understanding is, you know, radar is like turning on a flashlight in a dark room. You may be able to see because you've turned the flashlight on, but you also become a target because you're literally lighting up in the middle of darkness. Now, my understanding is that they've developed radar that means that when you turn it on, you're not detected, but you can detect the target, but they can't detect you. That's one of the newest generations, right?
You know, I don't know that for sure off the top of my head.
Well, I remember looking into that at the time that the drone was lost over Iran and it showed up in Iran. And apparently that drone has this incredibly sophisticated radar that can't be detected because obviously if you don't want drones to be sitting ducks, you know?
Right.
So I brought it up because it's my understanding is that whatever advantages we've gotten from new generations of stealth radar, those have been lost because of losing that plane to the Iranians, which, you know, obviously the Chinese and the Russians ended up with.
Right. Yeah. And, you know, are usually the originators of that technology as well.
Right. So tell me about what kind of allies do you have? You've got the facts. You've got the truth. You've got the very test pilot who did these tests, who leaked this information about what a Turkey, this $1.4 trillion a new aircraft is. So do these Air Force generals in charge of these programs, do they simply get co-opted, that they lose sight of being loyal to the service and to the men in uniform that actually have to fly these damn things, and that they just get completely co-opted by the contractors? I mean, what happens here? where is the tension between the buyer and the seller? In this case, and in the case of the military-industrial complex, the seller seems to be able to write the rules and make all the money, and it doesn't give a damn what the end product's like. And the buyer seems to be incapable of demanding that they get something that works for a reasonable price.
Well, there's certainly a gap in concern where how long these programs take. Most of the general officers that are overseeing these programs are going to be long gone by the time that they're ever fielded. You have a number of officers who are more focused on what their next job is going to be, rather than making sure that they are effectively managing the programs under their charge while they're serving the public. POGO actually recently reported on a program called From the Battlefield to the Boardroom that trains either retired or soon-to-be-retired military officers as to how to be effective on corporate boards. We'd like to see the same kind of concern for being effective in managing programs to be effective, and both from a combat perspective and from a cost perspective.
Well, Mandy Smithberger, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you so much for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Mandy Smithberger, who is the director of the Strauss Military Reform Project at the Project on Government Oversight. She has an article at the Center for Defense Information and at pogo.org, Leaked F-35 Report Confirms Serious Air Combat Deficiencies. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into President Obama's address to the African Union, where he criticized kleptocratic African strongmen.
Come, you masters of war. You that build the big guns. You that build the death planes. You that build all the bombs. You that hide behind walls. You that hide behind disks. I just don't want.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Francis Njubi Nesbitt, a professor of Africana Studies at San Diego State University, who previously worked as a reporter and sub-editor for The Daily Nation in Nairobi, Kenya. He is the author of Race for Sanctions and Politics of African Diasporas, and he has an article at Foreign Policy in Focus, Obama's Last Chance in Africa. Welcome to Background Briefing, Francis Njubi Nesbitt.
Thank you.
So your article, basically, Obama's Last Chance in Africa, the op-ed that you've written, pretty much puts him on trial and to the test, if you will. And how much did he pass the test, particularly with his speech before the African Union?
I think that he has tried to redeem himself, especially in his second term. He has attempted to, proposed various projects, the Power Africa Project, the African Leadership, the Youth Leadership Project initiative, and, he has increased funding for the health initiatives of his predecessor and so on. And also, the recent Congress recently approved the AGOA from the Clinton years, which is the Africa Growth and Opportunity Act. So there's no doubt that in his second term, Obama has done more than he did in his first term. But I think that still we have to see the results of his proposals, because for now, all we see is proposals. Power Africa sounds interesting, although for now it seems as though the focus is on fossil fuels and big power projects that have been detrimental to the livelihoods of people, especially indigenous people in places like Ethiopia, where he was when he was speaking, which is, there are dams being built on the Omo River that displaced tens of thousands of people, and they're likely to displace tens of thousands more in Kenya because it drops into Lake Turkana, where tens of thousands of people live and depend on the water for their livelihood. So there are some issues that I have with his philosophy, I guess, his ideology, which I think is a problem, which is a U.S.-based ideology that looks at U.S. interests in terms of security. We haven't talked about security, but I'm sure we will, but in terms of security and in terms of business interests. And if we're pursuing the profit motive, it's very difficult to have an impact on ordinary people. Yes, he's very popular among the elite in Kenya and other parts of the world. By the way, I'm from Kenya, and so he is extremely popular among the elite, those who will benefit from AGOA, the African Growth and Opportunity Act, those who will benefit from his various security engagements on the continent, and those who will benefit from the business side, people like the GE CEO, who, as I mentioned in my article, let slip the real issue that gets the United States suddenly involved in Africa in a big way, and U.S. business involved in a big way, which he says is to counter the Chinese excursion into Africa, the Chinese overtaking the United States, the European Union, as Kenya's, Africa's main trading partner, and also politically, too. The fact that the Chinese have managed to make major inroads into Africa diplomatically, politically, and also economically. So this is the ideology behind Obama's visit to Africa, and his policy about Africa is, I think is flawed. Yes, he's moving, yes.
Well, given that you think his policies are flawed, even if aid comes in the form of direct aid from America or from other countries, or it comes in the form of investment, in either case, whatever America could do for Africa, surely if half of Africa's leaders are kleptocrats and crooks and dictators, isn't a good governance an important issue? Why would you invest in Africa if the strong man's going to take all of the money off the top? And the fact that you say that the president is only popular with the elite in Kenya, he certainly seemed to have, the people seem to be excited about the trip, and certainly the applause that he got before the African Union about how dictators overstay their welcome and how that he, as a president, has to obey the law and leave office, even though he thinks he could get reelected. The biggest applause line he got was when he talked about, why don't they just leave? I mean, they've got all that money that they've stolen. So the people seem to know about bad governance, and that seems to resonate. So where would you put bad governance in terms of what the priority should be if you feel that the president is not doing enough?
Well, during his first speech in sub-Saharan Africa and Ghana in 2009, the president said he wanted to promote strong institutions, not strong men. Right? So he's referencing Africa's history, or the United States' history of supporting strong men in Africa and other parts of the South. So, he's reiterating that issue here, that we don't want to support strong men, we want to support strong institutions. But if you look at the actual record, you find that the Obama administration in Africa, and I'm looking at Africa as a whole, not just what so-called sub-Saharan Africa, the Obama administration's record has been very consistent with the record of other administrations, that is, strategically supporting those states, those strong men that have some kind of strategic advantage for the United States, while excoriating others for the same crimes committed. So, for instance, if you look at the Arab Spring and its its evolution over time, you find that the United States has come down firmly on the side of al-Sisi in Egypt, who is certainly a strong man, who has used the same tactics as his predecessor, and he, you know, executed hundreds of pro-democracy activists. So what does it mean when you say you want to support strong institutions instead of strong men, when actually on the ground there's a dual policy? You see, that's what I'm saying. There's a duality. That is, in areas where you have strategic interests, you don't care about women's rights and rights of, you know, press and democracy and so on. You know, those are superseded by other interests, strategic, military, or, you know, geostrategic interests, and else otherwise. So, but in other areas, you are able to talk about democracy, like you can do in Kenya. You know, you can talk about democracy, freedom of the press, you can talk about women's rights and gay rights and so on and so forth, but things that matter substantially, you know, the things that really matter on the ground, you're actually supporting dictators, you're supporting strongmen who are doing the same things that you're claiming you're against. So this is a dual policy, and this is a typical since the Nixon era, where the United States have, has this duality, that is, the exceptions like Egypt, like Ethiopia, for instance. You know, he was in Ethiopia when he was talking from the African Union. I don't think we should go by applause. As, you know, Aristotle said, popularity does not exactly mean that you're doing the right thing.
Well, but it does indicate the feelings of the people, and it would seem to me that that was what's resonating, and I don't know what can be done to bring about more freedom and democracy, even in the countries that he visited, Kenya and Ethiopia. The two leaders in Kenya, one was up before the ICC, and the other, and the charges were dropped because the witnesses disappeared, and the other one, the vice president, is still facing ICC. Then you've got in Ethiopia, they just elected this government with 100% of the vote while jailing all the journalists, which they're doing, you know, in Burundi and other places. And as a journalist, I have solidarity with journalists, and I had solidarity with the kids in Tahrir Square, and anybody stands up to dictators. So I'm not sure how to assign the blame here for bad governance. Surely it's not all Obama's fault.
Oh, no, certainly not. Certainly not. It's not Obama's fault. But maybe some of his policies have facilitated the maintenance of this system because for various reasons, because maybe stability was more important than other considerations. So it's not, I'm not saying it's Obama's fault. It's the system that exists today that puts elites, as I was saying earlier, in Kenya and Africa, as you saw during the address to the African Union, or even during the address to the civil society in Kenya, where he is extremely popular among the elite because there's a connection there. So that is, if you think about the African Union and the leaders, African business leaders that he met when he went to Kenya and went to Ethiopia. These are people who move in the same circles, you know. They send their children to schools in London and Paris and in New York. They shop in the same areas, you know, in whatever, in Paris. And, you know, they vacation in the same areas in South France and so on. So these are people with similar lifestyles and interests, and, of course, they're going to love Obama. Right, and of course the local people are lured by his African heritage, his connections with Kenya, with Kogelo in Western Kenya. You know, he has a grandma over there, and so that kind of symbolism. I'm not dismissing it. It's very important. Certainly, if you're a child growing up in Kenya, you're 15 years old right now, and look at Obama. Okay, it's an inspiring kind of story on the individual level. But if you think about what's happening at the structural level, you find that the structures have not changed, really.
So the only thing that I'm having problems with here is that I'm trying to find what kind of model exists, or whether it's an aspirational thing in terms of what has been achieved in terms of proper governance. And many of my colleagues here at KPFK and Pacifica basically make excuses for people like Mugabe and even Charles Taylor, Gaddafi, based upon the idea that all of the problems in Africa are a result of Western imperialism and continuing American imperialism. And it seems to me that it's true. If you go down the list, at least some of the 50, half of the 50 countries in Africa who have presidents and leaders who are kleptocrats and crooks. You've got Obiang in Equatorial Guinea there since 79. Well, of course, I think it's Exxon, or one of the big oil companies, basically, are the source of his money. Mugabe's been in power in Zimbabwe since 1980, Paul Biya, Cameroon since 82, Museveni governed Uganda since 1986, and he's clearly opened up his country to the U.S. military, at the same time harassing homosexuals. And then you've got Bashir, of course, who's been governing Sudan since 89, and he's been indicted by the International Criminal Court. So there's no consistency here. So what would you put forth as a model that's not hypocritical?
Yeah, I would say that the United States needs to admit that its policies up to now have been very similar to China's. You know, I've been hearing a lot about, China is greedy. You know, they're not dealing with the issues of human rights and governance and so on, and the United States is. But the fact of the matter is that China and the United States, their policies are very, very similar. They go where the returns are most profitable. And so, for instance, during his speech, the AU, Obama said that the biggest traders with the United States in Africa are South Africa, and it was South Africa and Egypt, right? So, and Nigeria. South Africa, Egypt, and Nigeria are the biggest trading partners on the African continent. Now, if you look at those three, these are producers of fossil fuels, oil, right? And the extraction of oil is extremely destructive to the environment, as we've seen in the Delta and so on. So so when Obama speaks of we want to change and transform our policies in Africa, it is hypocritical, you know, because you're actually dealing with and propping up the most vicious kind of governments and the most vicious kind of capitalist extraction. And when you say that China is immoral because they are supporting, you know, Zimbabwe and, you know, Mugabe and so on, and in Angola, it is extremely similar to me what is happening. It's just that the rhetoric is different, right? The Chinese do not deal with this question of interference in internal affairs. That's what they call it, non-interference, right? They do not deal with these issues of human rights or governance. They simply want to make business deals. The United States does, the rhetorical level, discuss human rights, women's rights, people's rights. But at the substantive level, we see that the United States is doing exactly the same thing. And it's United States and Europe, all right. I'm not just saying about the United States, Europe. They're doing exactly the same thing, which is extracting African resources in the cheapest way possible. And meanwhile, they can talk about democracy. But how can you talk about democracy in Ethiopia, where the government of Haile Mariam won 100% of the seats and crushed the opposition, you know, jailed journalists. Obama didn't mention that. You know, that's another example of this duality, this duality. But you said what your question was, what are the options available? Well, there are definitely options available. The African Union and think tanks like Codesphere have come up with numerous examples of what can be done to change the situation. That is, the West needs to stop supporting strongmen and build institutions, just like Obama said, but he has not implemented this. That is, they need to support the African Union's campaigns for 2020, which is a highly detailed campaign to develop for developmental democracy, where the countries are not just free, so-called free market democracies, but developmental democracies. That is, countries, this is the model developed in places like Singapore, for instance, where it was a developmental state, right, that actually was able to lift up millions. And, you know, you think about Brazil. Once again, it was a developmental state that was able to lift up millions, as opposed to the Washington consensus that focuses on the profits of major corporations and multinationals. So there are models out there. There are models. And these models are being stifled by the neoliberal ideology of the Europe and the United States. I think it's these are stifling. Of course, it was more so during the Reagan and Bush administrations when, you know, the Washington consensus, the power of the neoconservatives and neoliberals was more evident. But as I said in my article, I think Obama has advanced many of his policies, both on the neoliberal and on the neoconservative level, you know, by expanding AFRICOM, you know, the militarization of U.S. foreign policy, even militarization of U.S. economic policy. So this is not conducive to a good relationship with African countries. As we've seen, African countries have refused to house AFRICOM, which is the Africa Command. You know, it's still housed in Europe. So I think there are models out there, but they are not neoliberal models. And it seems to me that, as I said right in the beginning, I think that the ideology is the problem. It's an ideology that focuses on security and on private for-profit development, and that's highly problematic. That's not the way Brazil developed. That's not the way China developed, and that is not the way that other countries that are on the forefront of development today.
Well, thank you very much for joining us here today, Francis Nujibi Nesbitt.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Francis Nujibi Nesbitt, who is a professor of Africana Studies at San Diego State University, who previously worked as a reporter and sub-editor for The Daily Nation in Nairobi, Kenya. And he's the author of Race for Sanctions and Politics of African Diasporas. And he has an article at Foreign Policy in Focus, Obama's Last Chance in Africa. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.